Speaker. It's the tradition of the roundup on Friday evening that the speaker be someone who's living in this part of the world. I was actually going to introduce Bill from Phuket, but I understand he's recently moved to Malaysia. He'll tell you all about it. Please help me to welcome Bill.
Since we're getting informal, yeah, the right size. There you go. All right, hi everyone. I'm Bill. I'm an alcoholic. I was born on the 4th of July, 1961. Any other 61ers here? Eddie. That was a great year, by the way. Good man, yeah. I haven't met a bad person born in 1961. But I was born on the 4th of July. Would have been great in America, I think, because that's a pretty special day for you guys. Got rid of the POMs, I think, yeah? We tried to do that in the cricket. But I was born in a little country town out in Western Queensland called Charleville. And there's about 2,000 people out there, I guess, and I was the second son of an Irish Roman Catholic flying doctor. And he married a nurse travelling around Australia, and they had four kids in quick succession till they decided to bugger the Pope and try this birth control pill, and that's what kept us there. Four of us all born in 5 years, but my father was a pretty iconic person from the Australian outback. And he came from Tralee in County Kerry in Ireland, where a lot of people have blue eyes and crooked bottom teeth and have a problem with alcohol. I love looking in an AA meeting, you look around, you see the blue eyes and you wait till they smile and you see those crooked bottom teeth. This could be genetic. I think it could be genetic, this thing. Because out of my father, my mother, and the four kids, all of us are alcoholic drug addicts. So, and two are dead, four are still alive. My sister in the middle with me, she's sober today, and my older brother and younger brother are still out there. But my story kind of starts with my father, because he was he came out from Ireland. And he was a doctor, and on the way over, he was a very fierce Catholic doctor, and he stopped off in India and worked with Mother Teresa and worked his way over to Australia. And when he got to Sydney, he picked a job out of a hat that came with a house and a car. And one of them was the Flying Doctor Service up in Charters Towers in Queensland. And he was overqualified for the position, so they took him straight away, and he brought out his girlfriend, who was, they were landed gentry. His father was the district vet in Tralee, and he married down, I think. He married a hairdresser, and I think she came out and they were married. 6 weeks later was the first fatal plane crash of the Royal Flying Doctor Service in 1952 in Charters Towers, and the plane crashed shortly after takeoff and killed her in front of him. He was in the plane. And she got ran straight through with a hot exhaust pipe of the Gypsy Moth engine. And the pilot as well was killed. And he was thrown from the wreckage. And he never really recovered from that. 6 weeks married, and his wife was taken from him. And then, you know, he met our mother nearly a decade later, and married her and had us four kids. But I always think that she was up against a ghost. I don't think she could ever cut the mustard. And so she began to start drinking her sorrows away. And we were all mad as a box of frogs. So, you know, freckled face, snot eating, sugar gulping, crazy Irish twins, all four of us. And we used to live near the river, and I'd go down and from a young age and pick fights with the Aboriginals living on the riverbank. And my father wrote to his father about me when I was 2.5 years old back in 1963 and said, this little tyke, Billy, he's going to make his footprint in the world. And I realise he's right, because I'm standing up here today, and maybe there's a wrench for every nut, and maybe something I've got to share is going to be good for somebody, and it might not be good for you, but might be good for the guy next to you. Who knows? That's what AA is all about, isn't it? It's, something I have may help somebody else down the line, and that's what, you know, that helped me. That's what happened to me. But anyway, I do digress. Where was I? Yeah, I was down there fighting the Aboriginals on the riverbank at 2.5. And by about 7 or 8 years old, we'd become way too much for Mum to handle, and Dad was away being a hero in the outback. And so she complained and said, you know, I can't handle the kids, they're going crazy. So they sent us off to boarding school, and I was 8 years old. And being good, strict Irish Catholics that we were sent away to Brisbane boarding school, and I was in grade 4. Looking back on it, I think that's too young to go to boarding school. I've got 4 kids of my own, and I don't know, but looking, you know, I don't blame them for that. They just needed to, they did the best they could, and they thought, they can't handle us. We were really crazy kids, and Dad was away, so they sent myself and my big brother off to boarding school in Brisbane. And the day that we arrived there at boarding school, my father took us into the headmaster, and I still remember it like it was yesterday. He was holding our hands, and he said, Brother Regan, if you ever want to make an example of my kids, don't hold back. And, you know, that's okay when you're talking to someone who's got all their marbles, yeah? But this was an open invitation for some of the greatest hidings and beltings that anybody had ever taken. And of course, I didn't realise back then, but looking now, I know that, you know, these guys were very ill as well, very emotionally, you know, psychologically, had a lot of sex issues and violence issues, dependency issues, and the Catholic Church was a great place for people to hide with those kind of issues, as we know, in the 60s and 70s. And a lot of that is coming out now. In fact, my big brother is in a lawsuit with the Catholic Church in Australia, taking them, well, asking for a lot of money for them, for what's happened to his life. He lives on a little boat up a creek in Shute Harbour in Australia. And his life is wrecked, completely wrecked. And the same guy that interviewed him came over to interview me in Kuala Lumpur a few months ago and said, look, we've got a lot of testimony to some of the epic beatings that you took at Nudgee Junior. You know, do you want to join this lawsuit? And I was really drawn into it, and I thought, yeah, I wanted to get into that, yeah. Because after reading and seeing what a few of the other boys in the school had written, I'd buried that stuff so deeply that you know, him telling me what other kids had said, that when, especially one of these epic beatings I took in the band hall one night, where the headmaster had caught us mucking around and started to beat into me while I had the cornet. And this was in grade 5, the end of grade 5. I don't know how old you are there. But anyway, I'd pushed this so deep I hadn't remembered it. But apparently the testimony from the other kids was that I took such a hiding that night, you know, closed fist punches and everything. My eyes were gone, my nose was all over the place and blood everywhere, and I kept picking up the cornet and blowing it through busted lips and blowing blood all over the Christian brother and emptying the, you know, the spittle out onto his shoes. So he would unleash again and again and again, and I became pretty much a legend from then on, and I was the school captain, or the class captain and the football captain from then on. But I guess, you know, when I was, yeah, that, and that's a bit alcoholic apparently, to stand up to somebody. None of you guys would have done that, would you? You guys take a beating, don't you? Yeah. But anyway, so you can imagine, we decided we wouldn't go back to boarding school at about grade 8 and 9, and myself and my brother sort of cornered our father and said, we're not going back. And he said, you're going back? And we were pretty big, and we said, you're going to have to fight us to send us back. And he thought, yeah, okay. I didn't want to do that. So he led us, and we went down to the Gold Coast then, and he became the medical superintendent of the Royal Flying Doctor Service on the Gold Coast. Big, huge man. Whenever he walked into a room, people were in awe of him. He was the famous Dr. Timothy O'Leary, the flying doctor. And we knew from the three boys anyway, we knew from a young age that we could never live up to that. That was too much for us to live up to, so we might as well get into life. And I knew I was already going to hell because I discovered masturbation by that stage. And if you're a Catholic, you're going to go to hell. So I thought, I'm going to hell in a handbasket anyway, so I might as well enjoy the ride. So it was sex, drugs and rock and roll from about 14 to 38. And, you know, all the trouble that goes with that. I mean, I don't have to get into a huge drunkalogue, and, I think they have their place, but I don't know, in places like this, maybe not, because, you know, you're in here because you're an alcoholic, you know, or you're thinking about you might be, and I definitely am. So the way I drank and how I drank and why I drank and who I drank with and how much drugs I did with that and all the rest of it, I think's kind of, you know, I did a lot, yeah? I did as much as you guys, maybe. Enough for me to come to, you know, to cry out one day in a jungle in Phuket, something like, God help me, because my heart was coming out of my chest and, you know, I was holding my eye in, thinking it would pop out with the blood pressure. And about 3 or 4 months later, I ended up in a room of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I was one of those very rare birds that walked into my first meeting, and I haven't had a drink or drug since. And that was on the 12th of December 1999. And I just tell you that not to, for any other reason than to let you know that this is where I am in my journey today of sobriety. I generally get to at least 3 meetings a week, and I treat my alcoholism with the meetings and with the fellowship and with the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I found it to be the perfect fit for an alcoholic like me. It's given me, you know, today, this conference or this roundup's topic is the joy of living, and it's given me incredible joy in living. I'm married, I have 4 children, I'm still married to the girl that I met when she was 19 and I was 25, and she sailed over with me from Australia to Thailand back in 1987 on a sailing boat called Storm Vogel after the movie Dead Calm, which was one of Nicole Kidman's early movies. And God was looking after me from the start, because I had left Australia when they started breathalyzing the skippers in Airlie Beach. And this is one of the geographics that I made. And I have a very good friend that I met in Teachers College who drank the way I did. And we did an associate diploma in community recreation in Brisbane. And we met up because he was an orphan from up Ravensroad, Townsville area, and I was from Charleville out in Western Queensland. And we both drank like each other, and we drugged like each other, and we both played musical instruments and womanized, and we've been lifelong friends. And it's one of my great joys in the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous to, when I was about 3 or 4 years sober, I asked my best friend, why doesn't he come to one of these roundups down in Bali, at the Bali roundup? And he came along with me. He was he'd just finished a bottle of gin, and he was shaking like a shitting dog. And he was there, and they did the countdown. And he kept saying to me, "Billy, Billy, I don't know, I'm not going to stand up, Billy. I'm not going to stand up." I said, "No, you'll be right. Don't worry." And they get down to the, you know, 30 days and down to the one day, and I kept nudging him. I said, "Go on, Jimmy, stand up, mate, stand up." And so he stood up. And this is a guy who's living out in Lombok, very isolated place. And he stood up, and the guy that gave him the book, they invited him up the front, and everyone was clapping and cheering, and he couldn't believe what was going on. He was like a doe in the headlights. And they gave one guy that had 54 years gave him the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. and everybody wrote in it, and he disappeared back out into the middle of Lombok. This is a guy who drank harder than I did and longer than I did and was a professed atheist and had come into Alcoholics Anonymous, and he had to go back out to Lombok and do the program just from the book because there was no meetings out there. And today I'm very happy to say we just met each other down in KL, and he just flew up with me. My best friend in the world is here today. Where are you, Jimmy? He's got 10 years sober from that meeting. There he is, the guy from Indonesia. And that's, you know, one of the joys of living and the gifts of sobriety is my best friend is in this fellowship as well. And you know how great that is to have a best friend that you've known since you were 17 that used to drink and drug and have you know, those kind of times with, who is on the same journey that I'm on. And I'm often very envious of his program because he's got this direct line to the higher power. I mean, he had to get it, right? Out there on his Pat Malone, he had to, you know, work out, read the book, you know, one of the greatest secrets in Alcoholics Anonymous. And and he read the book, and he got this this gift, you know, this miracle that we all have, right? This is what it's all about in Alcoholics Anonymous, is to get this gift. It says in the 12 steps, you know, having had a spiritual awakening as... They're not even up. What? Having had a... Where's the committee? No. Having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps. And I remember in Phuket, we used to have a... well, there's a lot of sex change that goes on in Phuket. And we had this guy, girl, who was like a linebacker, I think you call him in America. You know, like the big guy, like used to play football. Yeah, a bit like me. Probably not as tough as me, but probably... Probably not as much heart, but, you know, a bit of padding, wear the padding and all that stuff, yeah. But anyway, so his name was Tracy, so we nicknamed him Dickless Tracy. And anyway, she had this real obsession with when people read the page 58 and they said, haven't had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, you know, and he would go... Every time he shared, he goes, it's not had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps. He said, had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps. And I still love Dickless Tracy for that, because everybody who read the steps afterwards would enunciate the, which is the most important the in the whole book, in my opinion. And I have got the podium, so I can give you those, right? So it's my opinion that the is the most important the in the entire book of Alcoholics Anonymous is in the 12th step, where it says, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps. And I found that to be the case, that I couldn't have had the spiritual awakening without the steps. And... that's how it is for me today, and I have to continue to live those steps so that I can enjoy the joy of living, which is in the sunlight of the Spirit, right? And I don't shy away from the spiritual side of the program. In fact, it's what the program is to me, and I have seen many people. Last year, even in Phuket, we had two hangings in our fellowship in Phuket. So, you know, it's not... it's a disease that wants to kill us, wants to kill me. My disease is out to get me. My mind is out to get me. And I'll just explain a little bit of that. I don't know if you'll relate or not, but, you know, say, you know, I'd be sitting in a board meeting or something, and somebody across the room might look at the fly on their shoulder and they catch my eye, and we sort of look at each other, and I think, he doesn't like me. That guy doesn't like me. I know he doesn't like me. But he's looking at the fly on his shoulder, and I don't know that. But it's like he's gotten up out of his seat. He's walked over to me. He's stood there with his hands on the table and looked at me and gone, I don't like you. Right? So that's what my head's telling me. So the next time he speaks, I'm like, I don't agree with that thing you just said. Because in my head, he's walked over to me and said, I don't like you. So I will say, I don't agree with that thing you just said, and your mother wears army boots. In fact, I don't like the shirt you're wearing. Anyway, you know where I'm going with that. And it says it in the book, we bring upon ourselves the trouble, right? And I've learnt that in sobriety too, that leave it alone, it'll leave me alone, is one of the greatest things. One of the guys in Phuket used to say that at the meetings. If I leave it alone, it'll leave me alone. What an absolute gem. Like for the rest of the world, the other 90%, they're not supposed to leave it alone. They can go ahead and do that stuff. They can go right ahead and get on with life. I've got to leave it alone. It's almost like I've got to leave life alone, because I'm running at a million miles an hour up here, and there's a head full of chattering monkeys, and one of them's just in the corner screaming and banging the drums, shouting out, I want a drink. I want a drug. I want more than this, a lovely sunset, but that's a great song, but this is a great party, but she's a great wife, but he's a good son, but it'd be better. They would be better if I had something to enhance this situation, to enhance you, to make you more tolerable to me. That's alcoholism to me. That's alcoholism. I need Alcoholics Anonymous because I am not going to do well without it in the world. And I've seen this over and over again in my short 14 years in the fellowship, that the boundary riders in AA, and I'm a scuba diver, so I like watching fish in a group getting attacked by other fish. It's great, it's evolution, it's whatever. I can sit and watch that all day. And the ones that get picked off, the ones on the outside, the ones that aren't moving with the group, the ones that are a little bit off doing their own thing, being a little bit unique. The shark or the dog-tooth tuna or something will just come in and just be all over that one, right? And I've seen it, and it's like I often ask people that go out and do some more experimenting. If they don't die and they come back in, I'll ask them, like, do some research. I'll say, like, what happened? And it's like those Indian scouts that used to get sent out from the wagons, and they come back and they look in terrible shape and they've got an arrow through their hat, and they're like, oh, it's no good out there, it's no good, right? No one's ever come back and said, I had the most unbelievable binge. I had the most unbelievable time out there. It was fantastic. Everybody loved me. I made a lot of money. I learned a new dance move. They come back in and they go out for me. So I thank you. Everyone that's been out, you've been out for me. And, I look at that and think, okay, this thing's serious. This thing wants me dead. And when I see somebody go out and they die, I think, okay, that person died for me so that I can have another day on this planet in this meat sack with this reptilian brain trying to work out what do they mean by higher power. What about is your God? Who is your God? What does it mean to you? Can you make a conscious contact with that? I'm really glad you can, because I can, and it saved my life. And it's not a religious God, although I'm very happy for everyone who's found religion and all of that. But I threw the baby out with the bathwater with religion. And I found that I don't need religion to get to God. What thank you, AA, for teaching me that I can also access this higher energy, this higher power, and I don't need permission from anybody in any kind of clergy. I don't need to adhere to any kind of rituals or dogma or books or teachings. I can be open, lay myself open to all of it, and that this higher power is not going to exclude me from the ride of sobriety. It's not going to exclude me from the joy of living that comes from being sober. And if I don't cut it in somebody's religion, because I'm, you know, be honest, I can't cut it in any religion. You know, I'm honest about everything in my life today. I'm absolutely honest, and I have to be, except sex and money. Okay, apart from those two things, yeah. Because I know you guys are all honest about sex and money. I know, I'm not there yet. So on my list of things to get honest about, sex and money. When I do, I'll get back to you. But I haven't had to, I haven't felt the need to take any drugs or alcohol to deal with those issues. But I do have to be honest with somebody else in Alcoholics Anonymous, that's for sure. Whether I'm, you know, and that means being honest with myself first, right? So if I'm honest with myself, I'm honest with somebody else in Alcoholics Anonymous, then I get this joy of living, this gift that's been given to me so greatly by you. And I mean, this is the funny thing with Alcoholics Anonymous to me. I'm up here telling you, just telling my story, and you know, you're nodding or not nodding, it doesn't matter. But you've heard it all before, right? The same sort of thing, pretty much exactly. You've heard it all before. I'm not telling you anything new because I don't have anything new. Nothing, not one single thing. This is what I love about Bruce here. He told me this part. There's not one single thing that I'm saying that's original. Thanks, Bruce. It's not. I don't have anything original. I came in here hopeless and helpless. And, you know, you told me what you did. You never said you should do, or else I'd be drunk and dead today. You just said, look, this is what I did. This is what we did. This is what we do. We do these things here. We do this other stuff. We do some service when we can. We do these 12 steps. We go to meetings. We try to be of assistance and service. And we try not to judge each other. Yeah, right. None of you guys are judging me right now, are you? Yeah, we don't judge each other in here. No way, that would be terrible. And imagine that. Like, you know, my mum used to say, anybody that that gossips to you is going to gossip about you. That's a good one to remember. Anyone that gossips to you is going to gossip about you. But don't we love the gossip, eh, the old alkies? Don't we love a bit of gossip, eh? Like flies to poo. It's a sickness, isn't it? It's a sickness. And it says in the big book, you know, why is that? You know, because we get to feel a little bit better than the other person, yeah? Because we don't feel okay. I don't feel particularly all right all the time. And since I got the podium, I'll say this as well. For me, it's got to be everything. It's got to be all the drugs as well. And I know in Cocaine Anonymous they say, and all mind-altering substances. In Alcoholics Anonymous, we don't have that. But that doesn't mean that I don't have an opinion about that, because I've seen what happens, yeah? I've seen, like, the guy, the boundary rider that comes through with the arrow through the hat. I see guys in here, and it says, you know, we say a little prayer, and I always say a little prayer at the start of the meeting, or if I'm chairing, I say, for the people who are suffering in and out of the rooms, because you all know it as well as I do. I have suffered in the rooms. I've suffered in these rooms, and I can see suffering in other people in these rooms. So this opinion comes from that suffering, yeah? So it's based in that suffering. And it comes from taking other substances. Now, you know, maybe I'm stretching out into an area where I should not go, but I'm going to go there anyway. You see, it's second step to me, all right? It's pretty easy. If I'm going to follow the steps, then the second step, you know, came to believe that a power greater than myself will restore me to sanity, yeah? So the word sanity is in there. So this is how we're going to get to my opinion. The word sanity is in there. So it means that when I was drinking and drugging, I was insane. Now, does anyone else think that they might have been insane when they were drinking and drugging? Show of hands. Okay, so you're going along with me on this. We've been sane, and we see the newcomer come into the rooms and that newcomer is insane. Yeah, anyone seen anyone else come in pretty new who you think might be insane? You know, great people, you know, fantastic, alcoholic, insane. But of course, if you go to the sanitarium or the loony bin and you ask, anyone in here insane, you won't see any hands. Because the insane don't know they're insane. Right? This is me. I came in and I was insane and I didn't know I was insane. I had no idea that I was insane. And you were all looking at me and smiling and I'm thinking, who are these people? These people are insane. So now I know that, no, you weren't insane. I was insane. So there, restore me to sanity, right? Step number two. So where does sanity come from? It comes from the mind. And alcoholism, I've come to believe, is a threefold malady. Physical, which we can find out all now. You can be traced. This thing can be traced in your genes. A CHRM3, it's called. Travels with, guess what else it travels with? Depression. Yeah. Who would have thought? So here we are, CHRM3 and depression in a genetic thing, physical. I'm physically an alcoholic because I have this gene. Which means when I drink and others are losing control, I'm gaining control. The television's all fuzzy, and then if three or four or five drinks, it's clear. I know just what to do tomorrow at work. I know how to deal with that person. I'm playing better pool. I'm dancing much better. Suddenly I've become richer. And things are going well for me. So the alcohol has made me complete. The alcohol and drugs have given me what I didn't have before, genetically speaking. Then, of course, this the mental and the spiritual. And the only way to fix it is with the spiritual. The physical's easy. We just don't drink for 3 days. The physical's over. We didn't die in the DTs. We're going to be okay. Now, the mental, and it mentions in the book, if that was the case, why would we need to come to these meetings? Why would we need to do the 12 steps? Why would we need to do anything? We're not drinking, right? After 3 days, the physical side of this thing is done with. But why? It's the obsession of the mind, right? I've got a mind that's going to explain to me in detail and rationalize that I can pick up a drink and it'll be okay this time because I've done some physical exercise, I've made a few business deals, my wife loves me again, the kids are okay, I got a new car, somebody's having a birthday. It doesn't matter. I will rationalize that first drink, and once the first drink's in, the physicality's in again, and off I run again into situations that I know are going to be very disappointing to everybody around me who loves me. And I married an Al-Anon. And she's got a black belt in Al-Anon. You know the Al-Anon handshake? Yeah, there's nothing new up here, Brewster. There's nothing new up here. But yeah, anyway, I'm still with that woman. She's a saint. But anyway, where was I? Yeah, step two. The restored to sanity, yeah? So if I... God is going to restore me to sanity. This higher power, this relationship I have with the energy of the universe, whatever I deem that to be in my own way, it's a religious way or whatever, it doesn't matter. I've got this connection and I've been restored to sanity and I no longer crave alcohol or drugs. Right? Then I'm at a party and someone's coming around with a joint. I think, well, it's not alcohol. It's okay. Or I medicate, I've got, some other things going on. I've got some ADHD or I got some ADD or whatever, now it's legal in America, right? In a lot of states, you're not going to get into trouble. You can go and lie to somebody and tell them you've got all kinds of symptoms and they'll give it to you, yeah? So you can do that or you can grow your own, you can do what you like. You're going to get this thing, right? Take a puff. To me, that is like me saying to this higher energy, I don't need you anymore. I've been okay, thanks for the ride up till here, but I got it from here, thanks. Because now I'm going to have a little bit of this, maybe a little bit of that. Maybe my back's hurting, I need some of that codeine stuff, that's nice, I'll go and see a doctor about that. Maybe I'll go and see a psychiatrist because, I really do feel a little down. I'm not going to jump off a building or something, but, I'll see if they can get me something that'll sort of go fizzy on my tongue. And you know where I'm going with this, right? So this is this return me to sanity. So these are things I'm putting into my system that are mind-altering, yeah? Would you say that? Mood-altering, mind-altering? Anything like that? So I'm saying that I've had enough of the sanity that, the higher power's given me. Thanks for that. But I'm all right now. So to me, that's like giving the finger to that gift. And also, I think that works in a way that I'm not going to get the gift anymore. The gift was on loan until I did that. Because the insanity is going to return, because that's what it says. It's going to give me my sanity back, right? But I need some other thing because I'm not coping. I'm not coping very well. And, you know, I'm not going to wander into that minefield of, you know, prescribed drugs, because my father was a doctor. And here's the story about that. When he was 15, he was a steeplechase jockey, and he had an accident on his horse. Pinnibull was the name of the horse. Came over a hedge, bumped with his other mate. Down went the horses. He landed on his leg, compound fracture, and puts both of his bones through his riding boot. He was 15 years old. His father was the district vet, so, and his brother was doctor to King George. This was like back in 1939 or something. Anyway, they've had to drill a hole. Instead of cutting off his leg, they got the best orthopaedic surgeon back from a snow skiing in Spain, and they drilled a hole through his ankle, stuck a stainless steel bolt through his ankle, and hung a bag of sand on it, and wrapped his leg in plaster, and he had a limp for the rest of his life, but he was 15 years old. When he died of cancer at 62, my mother and I were getting on the piss, which we love to do. I tell you, when you get on the piss with your mum, it's a bonding experience, isn't it? And I'd come back from Thailand. I'd been here a couple of years at the time, and I said, she said, "Billy, I've got a secret to tell you, family secret." I said, "Oh, really?" And you know how they love that. "It's about your father." I said, "Oh, really?" She said, "Yes, sit down." I said, "Okay." So we're getting smashed, and she says, "When I was pregnant with your elder brother, Johnny, I had to race out to the drome to give Dad his glasses because he'd forgotten his glasses. And as I was racing down the stairs, I was 6 months pregnant with Johnny, I shook the glasses case and I thought, they sound like they're broken. So I opened up his glasses case and inside was a teaspoon and a syringe. And I went, yeah, all right. And then it started to settle on me what she was trying to tell me. And I'm like, Mum, what are you talking about? She said, your father was a heroin / morphine addict his entire life. And I said, oh, no, you can't be telling me that. And it's like someone put physically a bag of cement on my back. This was the guy I idolized and adored. He was shooting up from the time he was 15. He got addicted to morphine, you know, when they used to make it in a paste. And He got addicted to morphine, and he would have been a vet or a lawyer, but he decided to do medicine because that's where they keep the morphine, right? So he became the most famous flying doctor in Australia, and you go out to Western Australia, everyone's named Tim because he delivered that many kids. And he was shooting up 6 times a day into his subcutaneous fat in his belly with morphine into his stomach. And he was an Irish Roman Catholic. Can you imagine the guilt he must have had as the head of the Royal Flying Doctor Service? And my sister tells me a story later when the drug police, basically the people who keep tab on all the morphine in Australia, were giving a lecture at the Queensland University, and she was in there doing her doctorate in nursing. And they said, and that's the way, they gave a big presentation, they said, that's the way we keep our tabs on the morphine. And my sister put her hand up and said, is there anywhere in any place in medicine in Australia where you don't really keep that good a tab on the morphine? And they said, yes, oh, only the Royal Flying Doctor Service. So because all these black boxes they used to have in the outback, they'd have them all numbered so that if you fell out of a tree or out of a windmill or got thrown by a horse or got, you know, stabbed by a fencing piece or by a bull or something, then you had the morphine on hand in your black box. It was numbered. So my father was cooking the books for 30 years for the Queensland government to make sure that he had enough morphine to keep up his addiction. Yeah? And my mum told me that after he died, and you know what? This is the alky in me. I really didn't want to know that, mum. Because she'd taken this father figure and basically brought him down to my size and made him much more like, wow, that's pretty amazing. My father's a morphine addict. But, you know, very sad what happened to him. He died of cancer. And I realised later that, you know, if you use a lot of morphine, your resistance to a lot of things goes down, especially cancer. And so, yeah, where was I going with that? Anyone? Step two, yes, return to sanity, right? See, my father would take morphine to make him normal. He became normal with morphine. He came off the horse when he was 15. He got addicted to morphine then. And then he started to live his life to fulfill that addiction. And in a weird way, this is a higher power thing too, I think. He lived and worked for... He was a very, very astute doctor and physician and surgeon. And he worked for the Royal Flying Doctor Service for less than a school teacher's wage. As we were growing up, we were like, wow, why can't we get up? A bike or a horse like everybody else, you know, because it was the way they did it. The Royal Flying Doctor Service would go and do some charity work and the government would give them a dollar for the dollar they made in charity. So he didn't, but he wasn't there for the money. And he got offered all these jobs to be medical superintendent of the Royal Brisbane Children's Hospital and down in Melbourne and Adelaide, and everyone wanted him to work. And my mother would be, Tim, we've got to take this job. It's like 20 times the money. No, Yvonne. I love the outback. We're not going anywhere. What would they do without me? What would I do without my morphine? But father was a morphine addict, but very, you know, really high maintenance. Like, it just made him normal. I didn't even know. Imagine being a child. And, of course, like those final scenes in the movie The Sixth Sense where... You know, Bruce Willis finds out he's dead. That's how I felt when my mum told me that my father was a morphine addict. I was like, yeah. And then, of course, all the flashbacks, of course. He would stop the car. We'd have to wait in a sweltering car while he whipped off and pretended to go and have a shit in the bush. But he was really like in there fimbling with his stuff, getting the morphine in, because he became irritable, restless and discontent. If he was a couple of hours after he's shot, and as a kid you understand that, he's like, wow, he's just turned from, a great father into a monster pretty quickly. And my mother would make sure he got away so he could get his shot so that he didn't belt into us too much. But anyway, so that's my story. How am I going? All right, on time? Do you want to hear any more? Step three, yes, there you go. Step two is, yeah, so, you know, for me, I can't take any of that stuff because that would be mean to me. I'm giving the finger to the higher power saying I can take it from here. And I can't take it from here. I'm honest enough with myself to know that I can't take it from here. I've seen enough of it. And look, you know, the celebrities do us a great favour, don't they? You know, Philip Seymour Hoffman, one of my, you know, I love movies. I'm a real mad movie guy. And I love that guy. Gosh, he was a great actor. Heath Ledger. And look, can anyone sing like Amy Winehouse? I mean, these people have all died from what I have. And legions before them. And it's like, here, I'm up here in Paddy. I used to come up here from Phuket. I came to Thailand in 1987. And I found it necessary to get away from my wife and kids about every 4 to 6 weeks. And I would come to Pattaya. Because what a great place for a drinking alcoholic drug addict Pattaya is. It's like nirvana for the drinking alcoholic. If you want sex, drugs and rock and roll, you don't have to go very far from this building. But you know what I found in sobriety as well? Is when I read the Pattaya Post when I'm up here. It's basically an obituary to alcoholic death. If you go through every, and we could pick it up tomorrow and check it out, I would say there'd be between 3 and 6 alcoholic deaths every day in the Patio Post. 3 to 6 every day. And they're not written down as alcoholic death. No. Or drug addict death. No. It's like man falls from building. Man has accident on motorbike. And you look at the time, you have to, it's an easy way to see if it's an alcoholic death or not. It's usually sometime between midnight and 5 in the morning. Where the guy gets on his bike and for some reason the alcohol and drugs in his system make him think that he's okay to ride his bike. And so he goes out and he rides it into a truck and he dies. But it doesn't say alcoholic death. It says death by motorbike accident, right? And, or man was found with a heart attack in the morning. You know the heart attack in the morning if you're under 50? That's delirium tremens. Has anyone else had those? I've had those. I thought, I'm dying right now. I'm dying. I'm having a heart attack right now. And I think it's just been tiny, tiny inches that I didn't have that heart attack. But other people have had that heart attack and they've been found dead in their rooms. And so Patio is a place where we come to die. This is like the elephant's graveyard for alcoholics. I mean, I know for me, if where would you want to go? And I think in America it's Mexico, right? Like, doesn't everyone, if you really want to have the great alcoholic death, you go to Las Vegas or to Mexico, yeah? In Asia, if you want to have the alcoholic death, it's Patio. We're right here. Each one of us can have the alcoholic death tonight. It's a 50-50 call, right? It says it in the book. I love that part about the book, right? In one of those, I marked it, but I'll never find it now. But it's, you know, we live life on spiritual terms or we die the alcoholic death. And it says that this is not an easy decision. If you ask a non-drug addict alcoholic whether you would like to die an alcoholic death or live a spiritual life, they would look at you and go, well, spiritual life. How hard could it be, right? But no, 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 not me. My brain will say, exactly how are we going to do the alcoholic death? Give me some more info. Are we going to mix some cocaine with it? Because if I'm going to go, I wouldn't mind going with some cocaine in there, if that's okay. Maybe a little bit of marijuana. A menage a trois, where there's no giblets. That's a shock. And so I'm trying to work out my alcoholic death, right? So that instantly says to me that I'm not sane. Step two, that I am not sane. I'm not saying I will be restored to sanity if I stay in here long enough and I keep doing the things that you suggest I do. I will be sane and I will be happy and have a joyful life. So I can't put any other stuff in. That's just me, and I'm not judging anybody else, right? I just seen the insanity, and it's so tragic. And it's what will happen to me if I don't follow these steps. And I got the best advice that I ever got in Alcoholics Anonymous at my first meeting, and I see a familiar face here. With John M, who was at my first meeting in Phuket on the 12th of December 1999. That's how weak I am. I couldn't even make the millennium. I lack the fortitude to even carry it on to the millennium. Weak-willed. Anyway, there I was thinking, what's this bunch of God botherers got to do with me and my drinking? And after the meeting, I said to John M. afterwards, who was cleaning up, I said, you know, I'm okay. I can have a few beers, you know. I'm all right. I have a few beers after hot day's work or, you know, I can drink the bottle of Mekong, but right down that last inch, I don't know if it's with you mix it with the Red Bull or the soda or something, that last inch in the bottle of the Mekong, that'll get me. You know, I don't know. Like, I can drink the rest of it. I'm fine. Just that last thing. I just don't know which one's got the bomb in it. I've been having a drink. And I'm having a great time. Next thing, it's like 4 in the morning and I'm waking up under the bridge with all the gatoys hanging over me like the Skeksis in the Dark Crystal, you know.
Are you okay?
I'm like, whoa, who are these people? What's happened? And, of course, there's no money in my wallet. Go figure, right? I'm coming out of these kind of blackouts. I said, I don't know which drink does that to me. Which drink's got the bomb in it? And I will love this guy forever because he gave me the secret of how to start this journey in that meeting. He said, Billy, it's the first one. The bomb is in the first one. And I'm like, no, it's not. I told you. I just told you. I can have a lot of those first ones. You're not listening. He said, it's the first one. I said, so, well, that means you don't drink at all. And he said, yeah. And that was news to me. I didn't like that. That abstinence thing was not good. It wasn't good news for me to understand that, like, you don't drink at all. No. Well, he said, today, one day at a time, which is the second great valuable thing, right? Because if I'm looking at the rest of my life and I'm not going to drink, that's really scary. How can I go the rest of my life without a drink? I mean, there's birthdays, there's weddings. What about when I walk my three daughters down the aisle? What about those days? You know, what about when something terrible happens to one of my family? And he said, no. One day, just today, you don't have that first drink because the bomb's in the first one. And that's become what has kept me sober today. But long enough anyway. Long enough to get what's really going on here, that I'm broken, that there's a big chunk ripped out of me like a white shark has attacked me, and it's all jagged. It's not like a Lego piece that goes in nice and easy. If I want to be made whole again, it's got to be a nice fleshy lump that's made perfectly for me and plasticined in, right? Because I'm different and unique and special, yeah? So where does that come from? It comes from me staying sober long enough to understand that the drinking was only a symptom of what's really wrong with me, is that I was dropped off on the wrong planet. I don't know how to live here. If I don't have this higher power, these 12 steps, this program in its entirety, I can't stand you. You really annoy me, the little things you do. Send me around the twist. On the road, what you do in the road, like you cut me off. Like, what's that all about? And then you're going too fast and you're going too slow. You're talking too much. You're not talking enough. You're not making the coffee the right way. You're not doing, and it says, I love the way Bill does this in the book, because there's not an alcoholic that, you know, had the Dalai Kurt take me through his big book study. And it was great because, you know, the actor part. And he said, he took me through that and he said, instead of saying, you know, the actor, use your own name. And I don't know if anyone's ever done that, but that's a very powerful way to look at alcoholism apart from the drinking part of it, which was basically that you don't do what I want you to do unless I've had five drinks. Then you're fine. I have no problem with you when I've had about five drinks or whatever else I'm going to put into my system, you know, I'm able to tolerate you. So you understand that? Is that sane? Is that a sane way of thinking? Is that the way the other 9 out of 10 people think? I don't think so. You know, they don't need to take drugs and alcohol into their system to make the world okay. The world seems to be okay for them. I've seen them get up from a table and leave beer in the glass on the table, leave a half a bottle of wine on the table, leave a half a joint in the ashtray. I don't know where these people come from. Like, even my wife, she's not alcoholic, but she won't drink. That was a great annoyance to me. I'm like, you're not alcoholic. Have a wine. She's like, no, I don't feel like one. I'm like, okay. I said, you haven't felt like one since I went to AA. She says, no, I just don't, you know, I can take it or leave it, so I leave it. I'm like, where do you come from? If you could drink, why wouldn't you? What kind of idiot are you in my bed? You can drink, but you don't? I mean, if I was in Al-Anon, I would drink. I would so drink. I would drink so much. I could even mix some marijuana with that. Because in Al-Anon, you're okay. You don't have to stop. But the person you're with has to stop. Because that person's really the trouble. That person needs to get their act together. Yes, they do. But anyway, I'm so grateful to be a member of this fellowship and for you to have welcomed me into this fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. I was hopeless and helpless and insane before I came here and you told me what was wrong with me. And well, you didn't actually. You just told me what was wrong with you and I could relate. And which is the secret today, isn't it? You just tell me the truth, and I can smell the truth. You can smell the truth, eh? We can smell the truth. Someone's saying something, and it ain't the truth. And you think, I wish that dickhead would just tell the truth because he might get over this thing. You know, but that's why on the coin it says, to thine own self be true, right? Because like Shakespeare said, then thou cannotst be false to any man. Because I do know enough about this fellowship or this program to know this one thing that's true, that you can't pass on what you don't have. You can't pass on what you don't have. And it's a shame when I see people trying to pass on what they don't have. And then the person they're passing it on to, it starts to think, oh, look at the guy passing this on or the girl passing this on. They just yelled at the waiter. They just started screaming in the traffic. They just don't do what they say this program gives you. And that's a shame, isn't it? Because I've found that if I do this the way it's prescribed without me getting in the way, like no me getting in the way of the thing, like this higher power thing, like ego. We have a guy in KL that says ego's edging God out. So if I can keep my ego out of the program and the fellowship, then I've just got pure program and pure joy of living to give to the new guy coming in, right? Because he can see it in my eyes that I've got something that he wants, because that's what I wanted. When I walked into that meeting, there were people in that meeting that are in this room tonight that I could see in their eyes they had something that I wanted, that I knew they weren't faking that stuff. You can't fake it, right? This stuff, if you're getting this direct line from the higher power, if you're doing step three, as our gentleman said, step three to me is an opening of that to allow the pure, unadulterated higher power, the higher energy, to come in and rid me of the bondage of self. If I'm able to rid myself of the bondage of self, I get to float through life like Teflon. You ever tried to stick shit onto Teflon? Won't stick. So when I am not in that state, then I'm picky. Things aren't quite right with me, and that means things aren't right with you, and you irritate me faster, and then all of a sudden it's all your fault. Now, I would be happy if you would just do things the way I say, but then you're not doing them the way I say, so I'm going to give you a little bit of my alcoholic passive-aggressive. Did anyone ever use that stuff? Oh, yes, I'll get right on that. Never. Does never work for you? Or selective understanding? I thought he said that. We are more cunning than a shithouse rat. Alcoholics are cunning, baffling, powerful, with or without the fellowship, I know that. But with the program in me, I become far less of all those three detrimental things. So I might leave it there because my mouth's dry. But I have really enjoyed being up here. I haven't felt too panicky, actually. I feel like I'm amongst friends and amongst people who understand me. And I hope to be here for the next couple of days and enjoy some fellowship with all of you. And if you see me around, come and say, "G'day, Billo. How are you, mate?" And put a lot of A's in there because that's what we do in Australia. We start with the M and then we go, "Mate." And the longer you hang the A, the better, the closer we are. But it's been a great pleasure for me to share my experience, strength and hope with you tonight. And I'd just like to thank the committee members for inviting me to... And, you know, there's... everyone in the committee, can you stand up? And let's put our hands together for the committee members. Go on, Guido. And I'd just like to read a little bit from the page 88 of Alcoholics Anonymous. Two fat ladies. "It works, it really does. We alcoholics are undisciplined. So we let God discipline us in the simple way we have just outlined. But this is not all. There is action and more action. Faith without works is dead." And then, of course, the next chapter is entirely devoted to step 12. But basically, very happy to be here and I'm happy for you guys to continue discipline me. As long as none of you have any whips and chains and tight leathers, I'm willing to be disciplined. Thank you very much and God bless you all.